Father, we thank you for your truth. We thank you that you have revealed yourself to us in your word and spoken to us. We thank you too for the way you reveal yourself in creation, that you haven't left the human race without a witness, but everywhere there is testimony to yourself. We pray, Father, that as we think about these things and how to speak to people, that you will teach us. In Jesus' name. We've got, I think, to point number 4 in my summary of the points Schaeffer makes here in this little article, A Review of a Review. I was discussing how the unbeliever is caught in tension. That brings us to point number 5. That is, as we think about the tension, Schaeffer makes the point that God is constantly confronting the unbeliever with this tension, with this inconsistency. The unbeliever has developed his system, his worldview, his set of beliefs about himself, about the world, about his life. And all the time, he's confronted by God with the actual world that God has made. Remember my two circles, which the person is living in between. And perhaps I'll draw them again in a moment or two. But he's constantly confronted with God's testimony of himself. You can think of Paul's statement in Romans chapter 1, verse 18, where Paul says that ever since the creation of the world, the eternal power and divine nature of God have been clearly seen in what has been made, and that men are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. And I've heard Schaeffer appealing to this passage over and over again, using the image that God is constantly confronting the unbeliever with evidence from the universe, from his own nature, and the unbeliever is constantly pushing it down. He's suppressing it. He's holding it down in his heart. So there is this, he's constantly being driven by the evidence to become aware of the inconsistency, to become aware of the tension, but he's pushing that down in unrighteousness. That was how Schaeffer understood those words of Paul there in Romans 1. Or you can think of Paul's statement in Acts 17:27, in the Sermon on Mars Hill, where Paul says to the people there on the Areopagus that God is not far from every one of us. In him we live and move and have our being. So that every unbeliever is constantly surrounded by the testimony of God all the time. And Paul again in Acts 14:17 says the same thing in the situation where he's trying to stop the people sacrificing to himself and to Barnabas. He says God has not left himself without a testimony, without a witness, but he provides for us, and so on. So that this is Schaeffer's fifth point then. God is constantly confronting the unbeliever with the tension, with what Schaeffer calls the illogicality in his own life. If you look at page 9, the third page of this little review, you'll see at the top there what Schaeffer says this. He says, many look at the beauty of the moon at night and do not want eradication. They're looking at, they see the splendor of creation, and they don't want what their own view leads them to, which is that the world is ultimately meaningless, irrational. They fall in love, and they don't want it to end in blackness. They experience the reality of love in their own life, which is a part of the world that God has made, and they don't want it to end in just nothingness, which on their view of reality it will. They'll die, and there won't be any more love. The human race will finish, and there won't be any more love for anybody. It will all be gone. It will have all been worthless in the end. Or they fear to die. They face death, and in their worldview, that's what should naturally come to a human being who's just a developed animal. But they fear death, and they feel they ought not to die. There's something in them which tells them that man wasn't made to die. And so Schaefer uses these three illustrations of the way God himself is constantly confronting the unbeliever with the tension, with the illogicality between his own understanding and the way things are in the world that God has made. Let me draw that image for you again. Again, I apologize for my drawing, but we have our unbeliever really caught between two worlds. We may say that he's, if you like, he's turned his face this way into his own world, which he has developed, but all the time he's actually living in the world that God has made. He's really caught between those two worlds, and God himself is constantly witnessing to him of that tension. And he says here, God can and does use these illogical things in unsaved men to bring some of them to salvation. Now later on, Schaefer stopped using the word illogical there. He tended to use the word inconsistent more rather than illogical, but at this early stage he's using the word illogical to speak about this tension. So that's the fifth point. That brings us to point number six. If God uses these means to save his elect, so may we use them and pray that God will use these things and will use our appealing to them in our preaching and in our apologetics. In fact, Schaefer says that we can use whatever is appropriate for the person. Now this is important, again, because he's saying that the person you're talking to is more important than the system of apologetics that you develop, because each person you meet is in a different situation. So you look there again on page 9, on the last page of this little review. He says, to the extent that the individual is illogical, this is halfway down the first column, we have a point of contact. Therefore, to a certain type we preach of sin and point out to him that by his own sin he's been brought down to the gutter. To some we give Dr. Machen's book, The Virgin Birth. To some we appeal to fulfilled prophecy. To some we use the classical arguments. To some we use the philosophical approach. We show them the alternatives, whether it's the man in the gutter or the philosophically minded unbeliever. We use what point of contact we can get. If they flee from the nearer contacts into the distant, we pursue them there. In either case, it is Christ or death. It is Christ or Diana, Christ or modernism, Christ or irrationalism, Christ or suicide. So it goes. The last step back to which we press them is into the blackness of irrationality. And if they're already there, we ask them why they haven't committed suicide. Now, what is he saying here? His point is this, that if, in fact, the person in their inconsistency is living more or closer to God's world over this side, even though in some ways their thinking may be shaped by the thinking of the age in which they live, if they're living closer to God's world, we may be able to simply use straightforward evidences to appeal to them. We may be able to, here he gives the example of Machen's book, The Virgin Birth. We may be able to show how the New Testament clearly teaches the virgin birth and give the evidences for the truth of the virgin birth. We may appeal to fulfilled prophecy. Now, later on, Schaefer would come to point out that this was really what Paul was doing. If you think of Paul in the book of Acts, when he's talking to Jewish unbelievers, when he goes to the synagogues, he doesn't talk about the nature of the universe. He assumes already that they're living partially in God's world because they believe in the God of the Old Testament. They believe that the Old Testament is God's word. They expect a Messiah. So in fact, he appeals to fulfilled prophecy. He shows them that Jesus was the Messiah. He's appealing to evidences. Now, he's not talking about evidences here in quite the way that it's sometimes understood in terms of evidentialism as a way of approach. He's thinking of it within this context of the man being caught between two worlds. Every unbeliever is really caught in between two worlds. But the closer a person is to the world which God has actually made, he will already have some ideas which make him more open to a very direct approach. You see how Schaefer uses the language here. If they flee from the nearer contacts, we pursue them to the farther. He's talking about the nearer as the person you can use here and talk about the virgin birth or fulfilled prophecy. The person who's accepted a totally non-Christian worldview, a humanistic worldview, is not open at all to hearing about fulfilled prophecy or to the fact that Jesus is the Messiah. Now, you see, when Paul is with the Gentiles, he doesn't talk about Jesus being the Messiah. They wouldn't have understood the idea, even. He talks about something different. He talks about who God is, the nature of the world, the nature of the human person. He starts with the issues that the person is dealing with more over here. We pursue him to where he is. The person who is most consistent is the one who's most over in another worldview. I'm sorry my diagram isn't very helpful here, but I hope it's at least communicating something. I'll have to think of something really, really good. I need somebody artistic to do something for me here. So we will use whatever is appropriate in communicating to somebody, depending on where they are, how close to or how far away from a biblical position. What we are to work to do is to find a point of contact. To find a point of contact. Now, the point of contact, again, will be the area where the person is inconsistent or where there is a tension in his own heart, like the examples he gives above. If the person is valuing human love, even though there's no room for love in his worldview, that will be the point of contact. If he's valuing rationality, even though there's no room for rationality in his worldview, we will make that the point of contact. Let me give an illustration from Vishal's discussions with the Hindu man who was coming in. He was a man who clearly valued his own dignity as a human person, who clearly thought that there was a fundamental difference between good and evil. Now, Vishal appealed to both of those issues in discussing with him, because those were the clear point of tension, because in Hinduism, in absolute monism, there is no room for the value of the individual. And yet here's this person with tremendous dignity, with a great deal of intelligence, an obviously delightful personality, who values himself as a person. So you appeal to that. You show him, there's your point of contact. He is valuing something which only has meaning within a biblical understanding. So you start from there, and you show him the conclusion of his own position. Again, my images are so hopeless here. If you like, he's standing in the middle. He's valuing his personality, let's say. But in his worldview, let's say he's a Hindu with an absolutely monist view, like this man was, that is, everything is ultimately one, what you do is you push him right over here so he sees where his own worldview leads, that it leaves him with no value whatsoever for his personality. So you're showing him the conclusion of his own position. You're pushing him to the logical conclusion. That's what Schaefer called it later. He says here, the last step back to which we press them is into the blackness of irrationality. And if they're already there, we ask them why they haven't committed suicide. Now that may sound terrible to speak that way. He's not saying it harshly. He's not saying it harshly at all. He's just trying to help us to see what we need to do. It's exactly what Isaiah does when he's talking to the people who worship idols. He pushes them to see the folly of their own position if they really think through what it means. It's exactly what Paul is doing in Acts 17. he's showing them how foolish it is to worship the things they do worship rather than the true God. So you're doing several things. You're pushing him to the conclusion here. You're showing him the conclusion of what his own worldview is. At the same time, you're showing him that the things that he values, that point of tension, that point of contact, can only make meaning within a Christian understanding. So you're taking the thing that is valuable to him and you're showing him that it only makes sense here. Like Isaiah, in Isaiah 40 through 48, he tells them, really, you're so much greater than an idol, you made them yourself. How can you bow down and worship them? A man can only have real dignity because he's made by God, not by worshipping something which he's made himself. So you're showing him the conclusion of his own position, and you're at the same time showing him the glory of the gospel. Because you'll never meet anybody who is completely consistent. There's always a point of contact. There's always a point of contact. As he says here, again, if the unsaved man were completely logical and so had no point of common contact, we could not reach him, for he would have taken his life and so be out of our reach. So anybody who's still alive, you can still communicate with them, precisely because they're still holding on to life, and life is God's gift. And to the extent that they're holding on to life, to that extent you have a point of contact with every human being. If we're thinking about the issue, the point that Schaeffer was making was this, that if we, like Bertrand Russell, say that there is no God, you can take his book, for example, Why I'm Not a Christian, in which he sets forward his arguments against Christianity, he acknowledges there himself that if there is no God, then my individual life will end in the grave, and the whole human race is going to disappear completely when the earth is destroyed, when the solar system ends. You know, there is no future for the individual, there is no future for the race. And he goes on to say that that means that there is no value ultimately to morality, to any kind of human achievement, to intelligence, to creativity, to anything we can build. And he actually says it's only on that foundation of despair that the soul's habitation can henceforth be safely built, only on the foundation of unyielding despair, recognizing that your moral choices have no value at all. Now, he's acknowledged there that if he were consistent, he should recognize that there is finally no difference between good and evil. It really doesn't make any difference in the end. Avishal made the same point when he was talking about Hinduism in the Bhagavad Gita. It's very, very clear in the discussion between Lord Krishna and Arjuna that Krishna is acknowledging that in the end there is no difference between good actions and bad actions. It makes no difference in the end. That's what amorality is, that you have no basis for morality. However, as you look at the life of somebody like Bertrand Russell, you see two things. You see, first, that he was a moral person in the sense that he wasn't amoral. He continued to make moral judgments right up until he was past 90 when he died. You know, he was out there marching against the bomb and against American intervention in Vietnam and everything else. You know, he was always making moral judgments. This is wicked, you know. No, he's got no basis for that whatsoever when he said in the end it really doesn't matter. But we can be thankful that he does. If people were completely consistent, the universe would be an appalling place. But God hasn't left himself without a witness. And human beings do have the law of God engraved on their hearts. And thankfully, they're not completely given over to evil, to thinking that it really doesn't matter what we do. So he wasn't amoral. He was a moral person in that sense. Bertrand Russell was very good at making pronouncements about morality in general and the immorality of nations, and his cause was man with a capital M. But what he lost sight of was the importance of individual morality, and he would talk all the time about the human race and the importance of doing things that were righteous for the cause, you know, really furthering the cause of humanity. But in the process, you know, his own life was an absolute scandal in terms of the way he treated his wife, who was very faithful to him, who loved him very dearly. And then when he was in the United States, furthering the cause of man, of humanity. He was staying in the home of a professor at one of the universities here in New England, and he seduced the man's youngest daughter. And for him, you know, it didn't matter because the cause was what mattered. So there was certainly immorality, but there wasn't amorality in an individual, in him, or really in very few other people. You occasionally find people who are almost totally amoral. The Marquis de Sade would be a good example, the father of what's called sadism. He had the view that because man is stronger, he can do whatever he likes to women, physically and sexually. And he lived it out quite consistently. And it was interesting, this man who spoke in our class yesterday in Christian Responsibility in Society said it was the Marquis de Sade's mother-in-law who had him put in prison in the Bastille in 1789, because he treated his wife, her daughter, so appallingly badly. You know, he really lived out what he believed, that you could treat women exactly how you wanted to. He said, simply because I'm stronger, I can do what I like. He was really a naturalist in that sense. You know, that we are, a man is just an animal who's sprung up from nature. And in nature, there is the survival of the fittest, of the strongest. I'm stronger, so I can do to the woman whatever I want to do. And he lived that out in practice. And the French Revolution was an expression of that, of the strong destroying the weak at every point. And that was an amoral revolution. It's a good example of amorality. You know, it had no moral basis or foundation at all. That brings me to the next point, and that is this. Point number 7. We are not consistent either. That's the last point that Schaeffer makes in this little paper. He says, incidentally, and it's really after he's finished, he says, incidentally, I think it is worthwhile also to call attention to the fact that after we are converted, we do not hold the Christian worldview consistently either. Many people are Christians with very little of a full Christian worldview, and none of us will be completely consistent until we're fully glorified. Now, this is really important. To have that humility about yourself changes the way in which you speak to people. And if you wanted to give a heading for this article, or for this whole section, or for Schaeffer's apologetics, we could call it compassionate presuppositionalism. Compassionate presuppositionalism. We must not imagine, and this is really what he's saying, that the unbeliever is in total darkness, and that the believer is in total light. Now we've got darkness here. It's not as simple as that. Of course, in one sense it is. When a person becomes a Christian, they're translated from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of God's beloved Son. We are fully acceptable to God. We are covered by the blood of Christ, so that we are perfectly received by Him. We have peace with God. So in one sense, we can say we are walking in the light fully. In one sense. But in another sense, we're not fully in the light. And we all know that very well. It's like Paul says, now I see through a glass darkly, and then I shall see face to face. God knows me perfectly well, but I don't know Him perfectly well. That is the reality in which we all find ourselves. Actually, any particular individual is on a road heading out of darkness into light. Any Christian is on a road heading out of darkness into light. We haven't fully arrived yet. We all make many mistakes in our thinking, as the New Testament acknowledges. None of us are perfect men, either in what we do or in what we think. Now that's tremendously important for the way we treat other Christians as well. So we don't think, well, I have a perfect doctrinal system at every point, and others are completely wrong. We acknowledge that we make mistakes in our thinking. Now, Why this is important in apologetics is because it enables me to speak with humility to the unbeliever. I am speaking as fellow sinner to fellow sinner, as fellow seeker to fellow seeker, because while I have found God, in one sense, or rather God has found me, I'm still seeking Him. I'm still seeking to know Him better. So I'm speaking as fellow sinner to fellow sinner, as fellow seeker to fellow seeker. And I must speak with compassion to a person who is living in tension. Compassion because he's lost, and because he's caught in the tension. Compassionately pointing out to him the end of the road down which he's going. You very carefully and very gently point out to somebody where he's going, that if he were consistent, he would have no alternative but suicide. You're not interested in arguments. You're not interested in making points, in beating somebody over the head to make them realize what a fool they are for holding this position. You are compassionately showing them where this would lead them if they took it consistently. At the same time, we're compassionately showing them the truth, which gives light. So one mustn't imagine that what you're doing is, if we had our other illustration up here from before, that you're pushing a person hard into his own worldview and saying, this is what it means. Don't you realize where it's taking you? It's leading you to death, irrationality, meaningless, absurdity, amorality, a hopeless universe. And that's all you're doing. And then when you've got him there and you've left him feeling totally worthless, then you come along with a nice word of comfort and say, actually, there's an answer here. That's not what Schaefer's talking about. At the same time as you're showing him where this leads consistently, you're also showing him that there's an answer to it. You're showing him where the darkness is. You're pushing him back this way. But at the same time as you're doing that, you're showing him where the light takes you. You're showing him what the light will give. The book of Ecclesiastes, which we're studying in apologetics at the moment, is a wonderful example of this. Because the major theme of the book of Ecclesiastes is of the total vanity of human existence. But it's not unrelieved gloom. Every chapter or so in the book of Ecclesiastes, there is another theme which appears just briefly here and there, showing that there's an answer to the problem. It's never spelled out in detail. It's not spelled out in its clearest form till the very last verse, that after death there will be a judgment of God when everything that is done and thought and said will be brought to light. And that's the end of the matter. Now, he doesn't tell you to the very end of the book what the solution is, the problem that he's raised, and then he doesn't spell it out in any detail. But all the time through the book, he is giving hints that there is an answer to the problem of meaninglessness with which he has begun. That would be a good illustration of what I'm talking about. So you don't just push somebody to absurdity, because they might very well commit suicide. At the same time, that you're showing them there's an answer here. Because you don't want the person to end up in absurdity, you want them to end up in light. So you're showing them the light at the same time. So with compassion, you point out the end of the road. With compassion, you show the truth which gives light. You have compassion because you've been found by compassion yourself. That is the heart of the gospel. Christ is compassion. He is compassion incarnate. And I have been found by compassion, by the compassion of God. And therefore I speak with compassion to others. And compassion because I have inconsistencies myself. Because I still have tensions, confusions. I don't live the Christian life perfectly, and I mustn't pretend that I do. I don't have everything clear, and I mustn't pretend that I have everything clear. I have some wonderful answers which God has given me, which I can share. And hopefully there should be some consistency in my life so that he can see there's a difference in what I'm doing, in the way I'm living. But I'm not in the position of having everything, and this man has nothing. You know, God has everything, and we are both looking towards God who gives truth. Who's given me some, and now I humbly and compassionately want to share it with somebody else. Let me give you an illustration of my own father. When I went back to live in England, my father was in his 70s. He was 74. And he was very ill. And he had been a very radical socialist, a Marxist, for most of his life. For the previous 40 or 50 years, ever since just after the First World War, like many other young British men, he was made both totally cynical about the prevailing order by the First World War, which was such a totally useless and worthless and unnecessary war, and so many people's lives were just so appallingly destroyed by bad leadership, both from the government and from the generals. And he saw almost everybody he knew killed. You know, he was in the trenches in Belgium and France. And he could never talk about it even 50 years later without crying. I mean, it was just one of those things that was just so completely overwhelming to him. And after the war, in reaction to everything that he'd been brought up in, he turned in the direction of Marxism as having the answer. So he was, you could say, a humanist. He didn't believe in God. He didn't think God was necessary. It was just man here. But the particular direction he'd gone for answers was Marxism in terms of its economic solutions, its societal solutions. Now, when I came back from the States, when my wife and I came back from the States to live near them, and that's why when I graduated from here, we went back to England to live near them because of their need. Because none of my family were Christians at all, and I had spent very little time with them since being converted, just a week here and there. Before coming over here, what I tried to do was to find a point of contact using the language that Schaefer is using here. Now, in his situation, the point of contact was this. He and my mother were both very moral people. If you like, they assume that the second half of the Ten Commandments is self-evidently true, like many other people in our society, though increasingly less, I may add. But they assumed that the second half of the Ten Commandments, you shouldn't murder, you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't commit adultery, you shouldn't bear false witness, you shouldn't covet your neighbor's wife or his property. But these were self-evidently right, that all decent human beings regarded these as necessarily true. And that was the way they lived, and they were extremely good people, as people go. They were a lot better in some ways, humanly speaking, than many Christians that I know. I mean, they were really compassionate people. I remember as a little boy going to taking every Christmas to an old man who lived alone in the village a basket of food. My parents were very poor. A basket of food with a chicken, with a Christmas pudding made by my mother, with mince pies, with all kinds of things so that he could have some kind of Christmas. And they were always doing things like that, really being kind to people. So the point of tension, really, was their morality, which was very precious to them and which they regarded as self-evidently right. And they were both tremendously distressed by the moral breakdown in our society. Because even back then, when I went back to England in 1971... all of Western society, as it is increasingly today, was evidently morally bankrupt. And moral standards of every kind, whether in the area of sexual morality, of honesty in the workplace, or in any other area, were decaying. Now, sometimes people will try and deny that and say, well, people are always the same. Well, of course people are always sinful, but there really are differences in moments of history. Just one illustration. When I was a little boy, I used to wander all over the countryside in the area of England where I grew up, by myself at weekends and in vacations, without my parents having any fear at all about me wandering around. Now, I've lived for the last 18 years in England, just a few miles from where I grew up, working in the Brie there. And I was talking to my mother about this just last year. You know, we have never let our children, I have three boys, wander around the countryside by themselves. And she agreed with me, she wouldn't have considered doing it today. You know, things have really changed. Children are not safe in our society, wandering around alone. They were 35 years ago, but they simply aren't now. Now, that is one illustration of what is happening in our society. Now, for my parents, that was a tremendous concern, and I used that as the point of contact. Now, I tried to show them very gently, and they were open to discussing. It's because of the rejection of God, people have begun to live more and more consistently to the fact that there isn't a God. And like Dostoevsky said, if God is dead, everything is permitted. Now, everything is permitted, and that's what's happening in our society. Everything is indeed permitted. And Sartre quotes that over and over again, Jean-Paul Sartre. If God is dead, indeed everything is permitted, and man is completely alone to do whatever he wants to do and whatever he will do. And it really doesn't matter, make any difference what you do. It doesn't matter in the end. And I tried to show this to them very gently. You know, of course, with your own parents, with your own father, you don't say, Dad, you're a fool, you've got it all wrong, you know, all your life you've believed these lies. And if you only had the intelligence to see, you know, this is just ridiculous. You don't speak like that to anybody, and especially to your own parents, you don't. My father's a very proud man. So very gently, I started showing him this moral decay that you see in the society is the logical conclusion beginning to work itself out of the worldview that you have adopted. Now, that was a hard thing to say, but you say it very gently. And at the same time, I was saying, the kind of morals that you so rightly treasure can only be held, can only have any real meaning on a Christian foundation, because there is a God who has a moral character, who is holy and righteous and just, and his character provides the foundation for morality in the universe. This is a moral universe in which we live, and good is really good and evil is really evil, and it will always be, no matter what people think. And that's why you treasure morality, because you've been made in God's image, and it really is right. You have this law written on your heart. So at the same time you're saying, this is where this leads. It leads to darkness, it leads to death, it leads to the decay of the individual and of the culture. And at the same time you're saying, and this is the answer to this problem. Well, that was really a means on which we could communicate, and he became a Christian. You know, and that was the point of real contact. Of him saying, yes, I see. But you don't do it all at once. We had discussions every day over a period of 3 or 4 months. And then he became a Christian eventually about 6 weeks before he died, actually with Dr. Schaefer personally, when he was visiting us for then, and he died of cancer. And became a believer just 6 weeks before the end. But it was this point of contact which really opened the door. Now, I've done the same thing with many, many other people, but it's a question of getting to know the person. That's why Schaefer says if you have an hour with somebody, you spend 50 minutes asking questions and 10 minutes giving the answer. What he meant by that was, you, in order to communicate, you've really got to find out who they are. So you begin to find out where that point of tension is, where there is a hole in the armor, if you like. Where there is a point where they're still living in the world that God made and still valuing what is true and right and good and just. And it's from that point you say, you start communicating the Christian message. Do ordinary people, the ordinary man in the street, the man out in the rural community, do ordinary men and women have questions like this? Can one approach them in this kind of way? And I would say absolutely yes. It's not a matter of using intellectual language or talking about philosophy or anything else. My father left school at the age of 16 and went and joined up in the First World War. He had no formal education. he was quite a widely read person, but he certainly didn't read philosophy or anything like that. He actually read mostly travel books about other cultures and so on. But he wasn't an intellectual at all. Now, I think it's got nothing to do with being intellectual, actually. But that is where I think we have such a confusion about apologetics. Apologetics has come to be thought as something which is for intellectual people. And I don't think it is at all. I think you can say these things to children, to small children. It's just a matter of using the right words. You know, when the Schaeffers first went to Europe, they went to do a children's work. They were talking about the world that God has made, the truth, to little children. They produced that series of studies on the book of Genesis and on the book of Luke, Everybody Can Know. And you can take the most profound aspects of biblical truth and communicate them really simply to people. Let me use an illustration of, I have a conversation which is ongoing with my barber, the lady out in Bolwyn who cuts my hair. And it's really on this same issue. She raised it one day when I was there having my hair cut, and she raised the issue of that, this was earlier this year sometime, when a girl was brutally raped and murdered just out here in West County. You probably all remember the illustration. And she said, why are there so many things like that happening? So I thought, well, there's a good opportunity to say something. So we started to have a discussion. She's not intellectual at all, but she's concerned about what's happening in our society, about moral breakdown. So I began to explore very gently, in the limited amount of time you have in a barber shop, what is happening. And first of all, I got her to open up a bit more, just to find out where she was thinking. And she was talking about how her own husband watches pornographic films and how distressing this is to her. It just gave me the opportunity to talk about general moral breakdown, that it really has a practical effect in people's lives. You can't just keep watching pornography and it not affect you. These images, these ideas really do change the way people think about women, about men, and ultimately they change their behavior. You know, people really are profoundly affected by ideas and by images. Their imaginations and their minds are really touched. And that began to be a point of contact to talk about, well, you know, what is happening in our society, why? Because people have turned away from God and His commandments and think that they can make up their own ideas of how people should live. That can be said very simply. It doesn't have to be said in an intellectual way. And there is no solution to this problem except for people turning back to God and having a really solid source of knowing what is right and what is wrong. And in fact, I would say that most rural people are open to this particular argument because they're generally more conservative in their morals. And they're really appalled by what's happening in our cities and in our culture as a whole. And I would suggest that not only in terms of talking to the individual, but you can preach on these things, and that we all ought to be preaching on them regularly. Because it's precisely at a point like this where God's word really touches our world today. So we are communicating the truth, that we are talking about a God who truly exists, who has a moral character, whose moral character provides the basis for distinguishing between good and evil and for moral behavior in the human world. And that what we see in our society is the ruin of a society which has turned away from that, insisted that man is the measure of all things for himself. You can say those things really simply. What I've been challenging the apologetics class to do is to try and think about how you would communicate that particular idea to children of 8 and 9 years old. I think you can communicate it very simply.